Because this is an appeal and a cross appeal, my goal is to split my time.
However you do it is up.
All right. I didn't know if you had a preference or not. My name is Michael Waters. My registration number is 10745. This is a contract case. It is governed by the 6-year statute of limitations because it involves a minimum purchase formula that is contained in the contract itself.
Let's talk about the elements of your damage case.
Okay.
You've got an obligation. You got the contract sets a price per pallet, correct?
Yes, sir.
And it creates an obligation, a number of pallets per month per machine.
Yes,
correct?
Sir.
Great. Does the contract say how many machines ABC had?
No. You'd have to introduce some testimony.
All right. But your damages under the UCC, particularly Article 2-708, aren't just the price per pallet times the months times the machines, are they?
That's the minimum purchase requirement in the contract.
That's not your measure of damages.
Well, then you subtract what you sold that material for to get your damages.
And you'd have to prove that that was a reasonable, it was a public or private sale, correct?
Right.
And you'd have to make some minimal showing of reasonableness, correct?
I would think so.
Okay, now and those are all facts extrinsic to the contract.
Well,
The UCC damage measure and the attendant factual inquiries such as public-private sale reasonableness, those are all external, extrinsic to the contract.
They could be.
Well, if they could be, they are, aren't they? Are they not?
Well, I mean, you know, if you want to talk about whether the price was reasonable or not, there was a contract. The parties agreed to that price.
I apologize. I misspoke. Okay. I meant your resale price in effort to mitigate your losses.
Oh, yeah. You'd have to present evidence of the mitigated amount. Okay.
Are there any Colorado cases applying the 6-year statute where the damages involve proofs of the types that we've been discussing, public-private sale, reasonableness, et cetera?
I think that the cases that I cited, the Rottenberg case is such a case.
Rottenberg was a lawyer. He had a fee agreement that set his hourly rate, and extrinsic to that, he would have to prove the number of hours worked. So how does that get into the, you know, the reasonableness, public-private sale, issues like that?
Well, I think the newest case decided last week cited a case, and now that dealt with hospital bills, so that's not the point. But it cited a case called Interbank Investments, where it talked about the written agreement stated that direct costs demonstrated by invoices verified by water district imposing tap fees would be paid by the developer. That's a case that was cited in that case last week.
Thank you.
All right. The minimum purchase requirements are within the contract, and whether you want to call it an order, fulfill, or purchase, the minimum purchase requirement is within the contract. And more importantly, Exhibit A of that contract sets forth the prices. It sets forth the price per pallet. It's done in pounds. They had 4 machines. Now, that's not in the contract, but frankly, they knew they had 4 machines. We knew they had 4 machines. And the months remaining on the contract existed. So you just put all of those factors together to calculate what your damages are. Then you need to mitigate your damages. And that goes to the amount you acquired on resale at a lower price.
That isn't a matter of mitigation as an affirmative defense under the UCC. Isn't it an element of how you prove your damages before any burden shifts to the defendant under 2-706, 2-708?
It is, but I actually viewed it as mitigation too.
Well, I didn't mean to quibble with your choice of the words, but it's not a defense issue. It's how you prove your case.
Yes.
Thank you.
The 3-year statute of limitations sets forth 3-year statute of limitations very much like the case that was decided last week, the Porter Care versus Lego case. That's a case where there's, and you can see the logic of it, is there's an implied contract in that. There's no amount set forth within that agreement at all, and they just give them a bill at the end of the stay, and the 3-year statute applies. There's no means of calculating when they enter into this implied contract. Our situation is very different. It's all stated in Exhibit 3, or Exhibit A of the contract.
Care services were already rendered, where in your case there was basically a promise of future purchase. And does that make your case different from Porter Care? Is it significant?
Not really. I think Porter Care, they emphasized the idea that because it was an implied contract, there was really no, the parties didn't say, okay, you can stay in the hospital for another month and it's going to cost you this much money. They didn't have any kind of discussion at all. The person just stayed in the hospital. At the conclusion, they give her a bill and they pursue their bill. Ours is a lot different. From the start, you could have calculated the minimum purchase. You wouldn't have to buy a single pallet and you could have figured out what the minimum purchase was, what you were in for a whole year.
And have figured out the damages at that point, because you don't know what the market price or what you would be able to resell the product for would have been 12 months later.
You may not have figured out the complete picture of damages, just because could we have sold the product?
And there have been any damages. Maybe the price would have risen above the contract price. I mean, maybe that's not plausible in your particular case, but that would be, you can certainly imagine such a case where prices of products do go up, as you know.
And then you'd have to question whether you pursue the claim or not. Because if you could have sold all of those pallets for a better price than what the minimum purchase was, you wouldn't pursue a claim.
Exactly. So you, at the time of the breach, you didn't know that.
No, you don't know what your resulting damages are. You just know what the minimum purchase is. You know what inventory you develop to meet that minimum purchase. When the minimum purchase doesn't occur, then you're stuck with that inventory. Whether you can sell it or not is up to you.
Did you file something in the trial court, maybe in the trial management order, explaining how exactly you'd prove damages using the UCC formula?
We didn't get to the trial management order stage, so no. The point is that the contract of MicroTurf and ABC sets forth an amount owed or a formula for calculating the amount, and that is why the 6-year statute of limitations applies. I'll reserve remaining time. Thank you.
Even though there's a cross appeal, it's our expectation that the appellees and cross appellants would present all of their argument now and leaving the remainder of time for rebuttal.
Thank you. That was my understanding. May it please the court.
Run the lectern.
I think I'm okay. If you can see me. May it please the court. Paul Herkum on behalf of ABC Pest Control. Judge Webb, I think your initial question hit the nail on the head, so to speak. This is a UCC case for the sale of goods. And with respect to the first issue on the statute of limitations, the UCC specifically states that the 3-year statute applies. And that's CRS 4-2725, so paragraph 1, states an action for breach of any contract for sale must be commenced within the time period prescribed in 1380-101. And obviously the title of 1380-101 is General Limitations of Actions, 3 years.
That doesn't mean that you might not, in a particular case, go to the exception that would invoke the 6-year statute if the amount is determinable or liquidated. Just because you initially go from the UCC to the 3 years, does that mean that you have to stop there, or could you not proceed to the 6 years?
I believe that under the UCC, you stop at the 3 years, in keeping with the general principles under the UCC for certainty. And the, I do believe you stop at the 3 years. I don't believe the exception applies, because when you look at this, the language in 1380.101.1a, that language is all contract actions, comma, including actions under the UCC, comma, except as otherwise provided in 103.5. I think that the exception is obviously the six-year statute. What the plaintiff appellant is trying to do is have the exception swallow the rule in this particular case. The at the time, there was no liquidated debt, or a determinable sum. And I think what's interesting is the cases that have addressed the six-year statute, number one, they all are distinguishable from the present case, because each and every one of those cases, services had been rendered or products provided, thereby allowing the parties to the action to know, I guess, what the box was that they were in. They know all of the facts. For example, the Rottenberg case, obviously the there was a fee agreement, and the only thing that you'd have to do is show the number of hours pursuant to the fee agreement.
Okay, so because there is a minimum purchase requirement set out, doesn't that in and of itself create the kind of box you're talking about, even though the services were to be rendered or products sold in the future rather than having already been done so?
Not when you look at the contract as a whole, because later in the contract it says that payment is not due until the product has been received. And it's undisputed in this case that of the product shipped and received by ABC, they paid for all of that product. And so when you tie those two together, that payment is not due until receipt of the product, then I guess you have your box, as we've talked about. Then you know what you have, what you owe. And then you can easily determine the amount owed. And all of the cases talk about the amount owed. The other interesting thing about this particular six-year statute, or the cases, is that none of the cases have drilled down deep enough to take a look at the legislative history behind the enactment of this. And as mentioned in my brief, the six-year statute was amended, enacted in 86 with a slight amendment in 87, and the specific language used with respect to the unliquidated debt portion of it was designed to help the debt collection industry. There's testimony, we provided an excerpt in our briefs, that the debt collection industry was concerned that the wording may prevent them from filing actions on an open account, which is based upon contract. And the testimony at the legislature says that was the purpose of that particular language, was to allow the debt collection industry to continue to pursue contract-based actions. In this particular case, the UCC, it's our contention, controls. There is no debt at the time. There's an alleged breach of contract for failing to order under the minimum purchase requirements, but there is no debt or unliquidated debt as contemplated by the six-year statute.
Is the difference between this case and what you're referring to as a stereotype open account case that here nothing has been delivered, whereas an open account case, the services would have already been performed or the product delivered, thereby giving rise to the open account?
Yes.
Thank you.
The case that came down last week, the PorterCare versus Lego, the interesting language used by the court there is that the court recognized in every contract action, it's possible to determine the amount of damages. And that simple fact in and of itself does not then make it determinable for purposes of the six-year statute. The bottom line on the six-year statute versus the three-year statute is that there was no debt owing in this particular case. The product had not been delivered. Unlike the other cases, no services had been rendered. So therefore, this is not an action for amounts due. It's really, as stated in the underlying complaint, it was an action for failure to order product, much different than failure to pay for product that had been delivered. And so it's our position that there's no debt because no money was due because the product had not been delivered. Any further questions on that before I move to the second issue on the lack of capacity? Okay. The issue that we have brought on appeal is whether the trial court erred when it did not grant the motion to dismiss for lack of capacity.
Counsel, can I just cut you, interrupt briefly? But do we have jurisdiction to consider the denial of a motion to dismiss?
I believe you do, Judge Miller. This was not brought as some sort of interlocutory appeal during the pendency of the matter. We waited until the case was decided. And in this case, it was decided upon the respective motions for summary judgment. And so therefore, we brought this cross appeal when the issue was appealed within the proper time frame. Yeah, the crux of this matter is whether or not MicroTurf had the capacity to bring this lawsuit when it did. The facts are undisputed that MicroTurf was a dissolved corporate entity, a dissolved LLC, and when a limited liability company is dissolved, the statute specifically limits what it can and cannot do. And since it's a creature of statute, it has to abide by the statutory rules on what it can and cannot do. The leading authority that we point to is the Alperstein versus Sherwood case. While that case was decided in 1989, I believe, under the then existing corporate code, the same rationale applies in this case for a limited liability company. The two statutes at play are 780-803, which is effective dissolution on LLCs. And the operative language in that is that a dissolved LLC shall not carry on any business except as appropriate to wind up and liquidate. And it lists five things that a dissolved LLC can do. None of those includes the power to sue. In Alperstein, the case we point to, the corporate code at that time operated to limit the powers of a suspended corporation. And the Alperstein court specifically found that the power to sue is not included within those delineated powers for a suspended corporation. The same rationale.
Document for the corporation was reinstated?
Yes, that is our argument. And for authority there, we point to the statutes themselves, and then also there's the SMLL v. I think it's Peak National Bank case cited in our briefs. And in that case, interestingly enough, the court in the, I call it the small case because it's easier to say than SMLL, pointed out that the inability to transact business amounts to a lack of capacity under Rule 17, and specifically said that the capacity refers not only to the power to bring the action, but also the power to maintain it. And the example they gave is, quote, thus a corporation may have capacity to sue when it files a complaint and thereafter lose that power under state law. And it cited to a California case. So the court contemplated a situation where a corporation in good standing files a lawsuit, then becomes dissolved during the pendency, and the court contemplated that case would have to be dismissed because they did not have the power to maintain that action. Here, I think it's an easier analysis because MicroTurf never had the capacity or the power to bring the suit in December of 2008 when it did so. And notably, the counsel for ABC notified counsel for MicroTurf about the dissolution of the company and that there was a problem for them, suggested dismissal of the case and recommencement of the case. I will note that all of that was done within the six-year statute of limitations, so it wasn't some sort of gamesmanship done on the part of the ABC. MicroTurf decided not to do that and instead forged ahead. And it's our contention that they never had the power to begin the action at the get-go because they were dissolved, didn't have the power to maintain it, and therefore the correction of that dissolved status did not retroactively validate their actions. And in the statute that's in play there is CRS 790-1005. That allows a reinstated corporate entity to resume carrying on business. The things that it specifically allows to be recognized during the period of dissolution are any debts, obligations, or liabilities incurred by the dissolved entity. The purpose for that is obviously to not protect the dissolved entity, but those who have done business with the dissolved entity. The effect of reinstatement does not allow for all retroactive validation of all acts taken during the period of dissolution. So our argument is that it does reinstatement on the corporate side does not retroactively validate all the acts taken. Since there was no power to begin the lawsuit, there was not, they had to have dismissed it without prejudice and refiled the action once they were in good standing with the Secretary of State's office. The final point on this matter is that MicroTurf points to the language in the statute regarding its existence, and that the statute states that it shall be deemed for all purposes, its existence shall be deemed for all purpose to have continued. That language does not contravene or contradict the limited powers that a dissolved corporation has during that time, and the existence is certainly much different than capacity. The recognition of the existence of the corporate entity is for the purposes of whether it's going to wind up or liquidate its corporate assets, and also has a nod towards the fact if it is reinstated, it doesn't have to reincorporate itself. So it's our position that existence is not the same as capacity under these circumstances. That's all I have, unless there are any further questions. Thank you very much.
On the first point, I just glanced at the brief about referring to outside or extrinsic evidence to prove a formula contained in a contract. The two cases I cited in the original brief were Hayes versus North Tall Mountain Corporation and the, I think it's Ull versus Fox. Hayes versus North Tall Mountain Corporation had to do with a broker's commission, and they had to use extrinsic evidence, and I think Ull had to do with corporate stock values. The effect of reinstatement is a statute that came about in 2003, and it was amended in 2004. And what's interesting about the case law that surrounds this issue is we get kind of a nice historical view of what the case law was when corporations were basically the entities, as opposed to LLCs and LLPs and so forth. I'd have to admit that when I was in law school, they didn't teach LLCs. but what it's interesting to read that historical background, because you can kind of see how the statute comes about. They don't really adopt the language, but quite frankly, I couldn't find an old corporate case on reinstatement that went as broad as the statute. They come close, but they don't go as broad as the statute. The statute starts with, upon reinstatement, the existence of the entity shall be deemed for all purposes to have continued without interruption. All purposes is, I think, one of the broadest statements I think I've seen in a statute for a long time. That is, I mean, it doesn't get much broader than that. And yet, it seems like the ABC argument is, well, it's not for all purposes. They argue it's not for the ability to act. Well, if there was an exception to that effect, why not put it in the statute? But when the statute opens up with a statement deemed for all purposes, it is so broad, it's so inclusive. Then the language of the statute continues with, the entity resumes carrying on its business or conducting its activities as if dissolution had never occurred. Now, that is probably borrowed a lot from the historical cases on corporations and reinstatement of corporations, and you can really see that. And that language comes close to kind of the traditional case law in this. It's not as broad as the first sentence. And yet, it seems like the ABC argument is, yeah, but there's an exception to it. It's got to be contained. But if there's an exception to it, it's got to be contained in the statute. And it's not. ABC then argues that the only acts that are retroactive are three. And they're listed in the kind of the third, what should be a sentence in the statute. And that is the any debt, obligation, or liability incurred. And they'll agree that's the only retroactive part of the statute. And yet the statute doesn't say that. It points those out, but it doesn't say those are the only three that are retroactive. And the effect of dissolution is not even addressed in the statute at all. It's not even talked about in terms of, well, what happens in this traditional setting of capacity versus non-capacity and reinstatement and so forth. It's not even addressed. The effect of dissolution is just simply not there. So when we go back to the case law that we use to try to get within this framework, you know, we cite cases such as Alperstein versus Shepherd Inc. The small cases, Mr. Hercom mentioned, that's SMLL versus Peak National Bank, which is kind of an interesting case because it's a 2005 case and it makes no reference to the new statute. So I don't think they were really looking at the new statute or arguing the new statute in that case. There's just absolutely no reference to it. And then, of course, Old Dominion Oil versus Lamb, I thought was one of the most interesting cases around there, and it's a 1948 case, which provides us the traditional framework of reinstatement of corporations. The bottom line in this case is that what I can refer to as the new statute created in 03 and 04 state, upon reinstatement, the existence of the entity shall be deemed for all purposes to have continued without interruption. This is one of those all purposes. Thank you.